Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, this is John Wadsworth talking to you live from Pearl River, Louisiana. And we're going to finish up on the creation, the complete creation in the Genesis record. And we're going to cover Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 30. And we'll talk about the sixth day of creation. Again, I'm reading from the Genesis record, a scientific and devotional commentary on the Book of Beginnings. And this Book of Beginnings comes to you by the Institute of Creation Research. So let's begin with our reading today. The completed creation. The world was now fully prepared for its human inhabitants, who would be given dominion over it. God did not need 5 billion years to prepare for man, a theistic evolutionist seemed to think. In fact, he did not even need the 6 days that he took. The reasons for taking 6 days apparently were, first, to stress the orderly and logical relationships between the different components of the creation, and second, to provide a divine pattern for man's 6-day work week. A regular day of rest and special fellowship with God would be the essential for man's good. And God's example would be the best pattern and incentive for man to keep such a day. Actually, the formation of the land animals must have taken only a small portion of the 6 day. The second chapter of Genesis describes in fuller detail the rest of the events of the 6 day, events which are only briefly outlined here in the first chapter. Okay, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. A most intriguing picture appears in the opening verse of this section. Whereas previous acts of God have followed immediately the phrase, and God said, let there be. In this verse, God speaks as it were to himself, and God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. He was not speaking to the angels because man was not going to be made in the likeness of angels, but in the likeness of God. Thus, God could only have been speaking to himself. One member of the uniplural Godhead was addressing another member or members. The fascinating type of exchange within the Godhead appears in a number of other places in the Old Testament. For example, Psalm 2:7, Isaiah 48:16, Psalm 45:7, Psalm 110:1. Similarly, in the New Testament, such fellowship between Christ, before his human birth, and the Father is noted in such passages as Matthew 11:27 and John 8:42, John 17:24, and others. The divine counsel centering on man had first taken place long before the beginning of time. Whatever is involved in the concept of before time, the Lamb had, in the termination of these counsels, been slain before the foundation of the world. The name of the redeemed had been written in his book of life before the foundations of the world. And God had called those who were to be saved by his grace before the world began. As in 1 Peter 1:20, Revelation 17:8, and 2 Timothy 1:9. You can read those for confirmation. On the sixth day, another such council took place, and the ancient plan was now formally announced, recorded, and implemented. The highest, the most complex of all creatures was to be made by God and then was to be given dominion over all the rest, all the animals of the sea, air, and land. Man's body would be formed in the same way as the bodies of the animals had been formed. It was in Genesis 1:24 and Genesis 2:7. Similarly, man would have the breath of life like animals, again, in Genesis 2:7 and 7:22, and even have the living soul like animals, Genesis 1:24 and 2:7. Thus, though man's structure, both physical and mental, would be far more complex than that of the animals, it would be of the same basic essence. Therefore, God proposed to make man the Hebrew word is A-S-A-H, man in our image. And yet man was to be more than simply a very complex and highly organized animal. There was to be something in man which was not only quantitatively greater, but qualitatively distinctive. Something not possessed in any degree by the animals. Man was to be in the image and likeness of God himself. Therefore, he was also created, bara, B-A-R-A, the Hebrew word, in God's image, both made and created in the image of God. This is a profound and mysterious truth, impossible to fully comprehend. Therefore, it is not surprising there has been much difference of opinion about its meaning. It is not sufficient merely to say that the man was given a spirit as well as a soul, unless these terms are more explicitly defined. The term spirit in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word ruach, or is spelled R-U-A-C-H, which is also commonly translated wind and breath. As such, the breath of life, or literally, spirit of lives, is a possession of animals as well as man. If, however, the term is used to define that aspect of man which is like God, the likeness of God, eternal spirit, possessed of esthetic, moral, spiritual attributes, then it may be a proper statement, at least in part. The spirit of man, like the angelic and demonic spirits, and like God himself, is an eternal spirit, whereas the spirit of an animal ceases to exist when the body dies, as said in Ecclesiastes 3:21. And goes back to the earth. In any case, there can be little doubt that the image of God in which man was created must entail those aspects of human nature which are not shared by animals. Attributes such as a moral consciousness, the ability to think abstractly, standing of beauty and emotion, and above all, the capacity for worshiping and loving God. This eternal and divine dimension of man's being must be essence of what is involved in the likeness of God. And since none of this was a part of the animal, nephesh, that's Hebrew, N-E-P-H-E-S-H, that means soul, is required a new creation. Let me read this sentence again. And since none of this was a part of the animal, nephesh, the soul, it required a new creation. However, this does not exhaust the meaning. We must also deal with the fact that the man was made in God's image as well. The component of man which was made was his body and soul. In some sense, therefore, even man's body is in God's image in a way not true of animals. God in his omnipresence is not corporeal. However, but in spirit, John 4:24, so how could man's body be made in God's image? We can only say that although God himself may have no physical body, he designed and formed man's body to enable it to function physically in ways in which he himself could function even without a body. God can see, Genesis 16:13. God can hear, Psalm 94:9. He can smell, Genesis 8:21. God can touch, Genesis 32:32. God can speak, 2 Peter 1:18. Whether or not he had actual physical eyes, ears, nose, hands, and mouth, furthermore, whenever he had designed to appear visibly to man, he has done so in the form of a human body, Genesis 18:1-2. And the same is true of angels, Acts 1:10. There is something about the human body, therefore, which is uniquely appropriate to God's manifestation of himself. And since God knows all, he works from the beginning of the world, Acts 15:18. He must have designed man's body with this in mind. Accordingly, he designed it not like the animals, but with an erect posture and an upward-gazing countenance capable of facial expressions corresponding to emotional feelings, and with a brain and tongue capable of articulate symbolic speech. He knew, of course, that in the fullness of time, even he would become a man. In the day, he would prepare a human body for his son, Hebrews 10:5 and Luke 1:35, and it would be made in the likeness of men, Philippians 2:7, just as man had been made in the likeness of God. Both in body and in spirit, Christ was indeed himself the image of God. Hebrews 1:3, Colossians 1:15, 2 Corinthians 4:4. It does not seem too much to infer that God made man in the image of that body which he would himself one day assume. In this sense, at least, it is true that physically as well as spiritually, man was both made and created in the image and likeness of God the Son. It is also noteworthy that three times it is stated that God created man in his image, as well as making man in our image. Again, it is appropriate to speak of God in both the singular and plural. God is one and yet more than one. There is possibly a hint in this threefold statement, as in Genesis 1:1, that God is a Trinity. In a sense, man also is a trinity of body, soul, and spirit. The word man is actually Adam and is related to earth. The Hebrew word is Adamah, A-D-A-M-A-H. Since man's body was formed from the elements of the earth, Genesis 2:7, it may be noted that man was to have dominion not only over all animals, but also over the earth, verse 36, from which he has been formed. Finally, it is made clear that man is also a generic term, including both male and female. Both man and woman were created, the details of this physical formation being given in Genesis 2. In God's image, and thus both possess equally an eternal spirit capable of personal fellowship with their creator. Going on, now I'm going to read Genesis 1:28-30. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat, and in every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. That's Genesis 1, 28 through 30. Having created man and woman, God pronounced a blessing on them and then gave them their basic instructions and commission. Whether he had created more than one pair of each of the animal kinds is not stated, although the seeming inference from the use of such terms as swarms and abundantly, might be that many pairs of each kind were made. In any case, only one man and one woman were made, a fact made clear in Genesis 2, when the details of the formation of Adam and Eve are described. The first command given to the earth, the first man and woman was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The King James translation used the term replenish, but that does not suggest the idea of refilling. Either the Old English term itself or the Hebrew word from which it is translated. The Hebrew word is male and means simply fill, fulfill, and be filled. And the Hebrew word there is spelled M-A-L-E. Of the more than 300 times it is used, it is translated in the KJV by replenish only 7 times. And even these could be well have been rendered fill. It is certainly erroneous to use this one verse as a proof text for the gap theory, as many have done. Man has not yet filled the earth in accordance with God's command. Nevertheless, many people today are unduly alarmed over the so-called population explosion, urging government controls of various sorts to slow down the population growth. We can be sure that God's command, repeated incidentally after the flood, was made in full knowledge of the earth's ability to support a large population. Note Genesis 9:1. And it has never been rescinded, even at the present level of man's technological knowledge. The earth could support a much larger population than it now holds. Obviously, it could not continue to grow indefinitely without limit, but God, no doubt, has made adequate provision for such an eventuality. For one thing, the scriptures promise that Christ will return before man has completely destroyed his world, a prospect which, humanly speaking, seems more of an imminent danger than overpopulation. Further, there is quite a bit of evidence in the studies of animal populations that when a given group increases in numbers to an optimum number for its own ecological niche, the population stabilizes because of a struggle for existence conflict, but by virtue of built-in psychological and physiological mechanisms which somehow slow down the reproductive activity of the population. It is possible that God would do the same with the human population. Another possibility is that had man not failed his probation in Eden, he would have eventually been allowed to colonize other planets as his population grew. Such idea or speculation, only since human populations have not yet reached the optimum level even for our present decaying planet. In addition to the command for procreation in Genesis, and Genesis 2 makes it plain that this was to be within the framework of monogamous marriage, God instructed man to subdue the earth and to have dominion over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. These are military and then rule. In context, however, there is no actual conflict suggested, since everything God has made was pronounced good. The cultural mandate, as some have called it, is clearly a very expressive figure of speech. Four, first intense study of the earth. With all the intricate processes and complex systems, and then utilization of the knowledge for the benefit of the earth's inhabitants, both animal and human. Here is the primeval commission to man, authorizing both science and technology as man's basic enterprise relative to the earth. Science is man's disciplined study and understanding of the phenomenon of his world. Technology is the implementation of the knowledge in the effective ordering and development of the earth and its resources for the greater good of all earth's inhabitants, including such fields of human service as engineering, agriculture, medicine, and a host of other practical technologies. This twofold commission to subdue and have dominion, to conquer and rule, embraces all the productive human activities, science and technology, research and development, theory and application, study and practice, and so forth, are various ways of expressing these two concepts. The command, therefore, established man as God's steward over the created world and all things therein. Thou madest him to make dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. Psalm 8, 6 through 8. However, as the writer of Hebrews says, commenting on this passage, but now we see not yet all things put under him, Hebrews 2:8. The problem is, of course, that man has failed in his stewardship. Instead of using earth for good and under God, he has denied God and abused his stewardship. The primeval commission has never been abrogated. Man is still under its obligation. The scientific and technological enterprises still comprise God's mandate to man relative to the earth and its inhabitants. And man would find himself immeasurably more productive and effective in such pursuits if he would only approach them in the reverent and believing attitude of an honest and good servant of his Maker. After giving man his commission, God told him of the provision for his most essential need, that of food. Man had work to do, and would need a repeated renewal of energy to continue to work. This was to be provided through the marvelous digestive system and internal energy conversion apparatus designed by God as a part of man's body, as well as those of the animals. This energy supply was to be perpetually available through the fruits and herbs of the biosphere established by God on the third day of creation. The supply could not be exhausted since these plants were designed to replicate themselves. via the bearing of the yielding of the seed. Furthermore, as man spread out and filled the earth, his food would be available everywhere upon the face of the earth. There were primevally no deserts and other uninhabitable regions. The animals, too, were to obtain their food from every green herb, a term evidently meaning all green plants, including grasses. They also had a work to do. Under man's direction, even though at this late date, after a millennium of fearing and dreading man in a cursed world, note Genesis 9:2, it may be difficult or impossible to determine exactly the original nature of intended functions of the different kinds of animals. It is clear from the passage that in original creation, it was not intended that either man or animal should eat animal food. As far as man was concerned, this was changed at the time of the flood in Genesis 9:3, as will be discussed later. Whether some of the antediluvian ventured to do this against God's command, we are not told. Although it is possible, Jabal introduced cattle raising in Genesis 4:2. As far as carnivorous animals are concerned, their desire for meat must have been a later development, even at the time of the curse or after the flood. Even today, of course, such animals can and will, if they have to, live on a vegetarian diet. Whether such structures as fangs and claws were part of the original equipment or were recessive features which only became dominant due to selection processes later, or were mutational features following the curse, or exactly what must await further research. The same uncertainty must prevail at this point as to how the present balance of nature arrangements developed in various environments, whereby predators keep in check the large numbers of lower animals that would otherwise take over. It is at least possible that the primeval balances in every environment, including the phylactery of each kind, were quite different than at present. So the predation was neither needed nor desired. The scriptures do predict that in the world of the future, after Christ has returned and restored the earth in part to its primeval perfection, there will be once again no predation or struggle between animals or between animals and man. Note Isaiah 11:6-9 and Hosea 2:18. Well, that's it for today. God bless you. And until next time, may God be in your thoughts and desire and direct your ways.